This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the program, we get up close and personal with Western Sydney's Pacific community to hear about what they want ahead of Australia's federal election.
My main concern is really getting a leader in that willing to see what's happening in their own backyard within our community and definitely stepping in and taking charge to make a change.
Also, we'll hear about how the Marshall Islands is taking a global lead in the crackdown on illegal fishing, and we'll take a look at one of PNG's most beloved native animals. And we'll ask one of the experts, could this be the year that animal finally gets its own international day? All that and more today on Pacific Beat. I'm Nick Fogarty. Thanks for joining me. First, though, Australia's federal election is just 2 weeks away, with the Liberals and Labor in peak campaign mode. Among those heading to the polls will be voters in Western Sydney, which happens to be one of Australia's most multicultural electorates and plays host to a large Pacific population. Pacific Beat's Dubravka Volador visited the suburb of Mount Druitt, where the cost of living, visas, climate change and youth violence are top of mind for voters there.
Samoan Australian Aniva Moeono has a podcast starring the voices and stories of her local community. It's part of the Street University project that gives youths a creative platform and meeting place.
So were you raised by your mum?
Yeah, raised from by my mum and dad, but my old man.
In her podcast, the 27-year-old features the world she sees around her in Western Sydney.
And then, yeah, since then, raised by our mum. So,
as you can see, within Mount Druitt, there wasn't too many platforms for our people to go and speak on. So we decided to start our own podcast and get our people on and give them a safe space and a safe platform for them to come and speak and for their voices to be heard.
And the world that you see around you, has that influenced the way you approach your podcast?
Oh, absolutely, especially with the street violence that take place in all our areas, especially for the next generations to come, just to make sure that they know that there's more to life out there and also, you know, that there's different avenues that they can take other than the streets.
We have an election coming up. What are the main concerns for yourself, maybe for your community and perhaps even the whole country?
My main concern is really getting a leader in that willing to see what's happening in their own backyard within our community and definitely stepping in and taking charge to make a change.
In the election, are you planning to vote? And if so, who for?
I am planning to vote, and who for? I think I'll keep that one a secret.
That's fine. Yeah. Aniva's story is one of creativity and absolute dedication to her community. Hers is the Mount Druitt Pacific community, which, like the rest of Western Sydney, is home to many Pacific Islanders. It's about 43 kilometres from the CBD, and there's a mix of family homes with neat gardens and apartment buildings here. I just walked past a Westfield shopping centre and small shops selling fruit and veggies and other items. This area has been one of the hardest hit during the COVID lockdown. I'm walking down the road to meet Maharao Arona, who's the president of the Pacific Mount Druitt Action Network.
Yeah, definitely. I've got a nine. That's okay.
I guess the main concerns for me at the moment is the cost of living for our people here in Australia and Sydney. Sydney's very expensive. Families that come over, it's not easy to live here unless you've got a very good plan.
So I've seen that you've been working in the area for about 17 years. How much has changed, and have things become worse or better?
Unless you came before 2001, it's a real struggle for families to survive in Sydney. You don't have the access to services or assistance that's available for others. my place of work is around homelessness at the moment, and there's a lot of issues with families not having been able to afford a home because renting and housing in Sydney is very, very expensive.
Now, the government says the country needs stability and economic stability. Is that something you agree with?
No, of course I don't agree, because we wouldn't have a high unemployment rate as we do here.
And what would you like to see addressed in this election?
I would really love for there to be a change for our people to have the visa access change, and also climate change is an issue.
Now, it's the election soon. Who will you be voting for?
Of course I'm going to vote, but who will I vote for? I'm not sure.
Also here with us at Mission Australia is Samoan mother of three, Dora Onesemo, who works for the health service. What are the main issues as far as you can see?
You know, we have big families. There's not enough income coming in for the families, so which where normally the mom has to stay home and there's one parent has to go to work. So there's one income to support that whole family, and there might be grandparents living there as well, or extended family. There's a lot of people to support on this one income relative to the services from the government. There's only certain, you know, payments they can access. So they have everything is out of pocket for them. So having to, you know, if you have a child that has issues, you know, that needs that special attention and special support. So, yeah, this is really a big struggle.
Do you think over these years things have changed a bit, or do you think the issues have stayed the same?
Not only working in our Western Sydney communities and in Mount Druitt Blacktown, but also living here, things definitely have gone worse, and especially with the high cost of housing. The families are having issues accessing, you know, proper housing because it's so expensive. Yeah, and also with the onflow of the effects of COVID, like people are still trying to get back from that.
There is an election coming up. Can you vote?
No, I cannot, because I am not a citizen, and I'm a New Zealand citizen, yes.
We have heard from three women in the community, but what about the men? I'm now meeting Lawrence Tawasa, who's a parent liaison at the Chifley College School here in Mount Druitt. What's his experience?
Coming from an educational point of view, I think a lot of the issues that we're dealing with right now is the youth violence, or the postcode, whatever they call it, gangs and the violence that's happening. I think that's one issue that needs to be addressed and having conversations about. I think it's a conversation that the community needs to have. It starts from home. Yeah, I think we've got to give the responsibility back to the parents. Yeah, and also the community. But we need everyone on board. We need the school on board. We need the police on board. We need government on board and local MPs on board.
In terms of this election, what are the main issues you would like to see addressed?
Yeah, I'd like to see more support for the family and identify people that need that support. And also, I'm a big fan of the elderly.
Last time we spoke to each other, you told me that you are distributing food hampers to families in need. Are you still doing that? Is that still ongoing, that project?
Oh, yeah, that's still ongoing. None of my projects are government funded. We identify from my school, we identify our students that and families that need their support throughout the whole year. And we deliver food hampers to them, and it's all free.
Now, the election's coming up soon. Will you vote? And can I ask who you will vote for?
But, yeah, I'll be voting. I don't know. I think there needs to be a change.
Dubrovka Volodar reporting.
Pacific Beat.
Data that countries collect about the fishing activity in their waters is often kept highly confidential. But the Marshall Islands has just become the first Pacific nation to share that information publicly with the world. In a bid to increase transparency and crack down on illegal fishing, Marshall Islands has partnered with NGO Global Fishing Watch. The organisation's program manager for the Pacific, Dr. Kamal Azmi, spoke with Marion Farr about the work being done.
Its mission is to advance sustainability of our marine resources by increasing transparency of human activity at sea. So what that means is we use various forms of satellite data and machine learning to identify fishing activity at sea, often where it is hard to otherwise detect, you know, far out from shore. And we display that data through a map on our website, or actually a couple of maps, so it's visible to the public free of charge.
And why is increasing transparency so important for, I guess, yeah, protecting the oceans and ocean resources?
Sure. Well, just generally, transparency is good for good governance. So applying that to the oceans, being able to know where the fish that you're eating has come from, that it was caught sustainably, that it was caught on vessels that are not mistreating their crew, that it was not caught using methods that are prohibited that cause ecological damage, is all important parts of a sustainable fishery. And so understanding that, the public wants to know that increasingly, and so do fisheries authorities who want to maintain the sustainability and the reputations of the fisheries that they manage.
And so Marshall Islands has just become, I understand, the first Pacific country to sign up to share its fishing data publicly with Global Fishing Watch. Why is that significant?
It's really terrific. We're very excited about this. Yeah, Marshall Islands is the first country in the Western Pacific to agree to an arrangement like this to share its vessel monitoring system data. We have a number of countries that already do share vessel monitoring system data, including Belize, Brazil, Chile, Costa Rica, Ecuador, Panama and Peru. But they're all in Latin America, and it's fantastic that that's happening there. We'd like to see it move to other parts of the world. So we're working with partners in Africa and in Europe and in Oceania as well. And Marshall Islands has been the first to sign an MOU with Global Fishing Watch. What Marshall Islands is sharing and what those other countries in Latin America have shared is called Vessel Monitoring System Data, or VMS. VMS is often mandated by fisheries authorities. So if you want to fish within a country's exclusive economic zone, you may be required to transmit VMS data to the fisheries authority. But that VMS data is often confidential. Often the instinct is to make this data confidential, when in fact it doesn't really need to be. And so Marshall Islands will display its vessel monitoring system data in addition to our AIS data on our website.
And does this type of platform help, I guess, combat illegal fishing in the region?
Yes, it certainly does. It's not intended to replace existing monitoring, control and surveillance by fisheries authorities. It's intended as an additional tool. Marshall Islands is a member of the Pacific Islands Forum Fisheries Agency, the FFA. The FFA and its members have an incredibly sophisticated vessel monitoring system across all of its members, all its 17 members. So we bring this additional tools and analysis using the satellite data as a complementary part of the toolkit. And IUU fishing, illegal, unreported and unregulated fishing, is an issue in fisheries. I'm glad to say that the most recent estimate of the extent of IUU fishing in the Pacific has shown that it's actually quite low. And the biggest problem really is unreported fishing and misreported fishing rather than illegal per se. So that's a really good thing for the Pacific. And so for Pacific Island countries, they want to maintain that reputation that IUU fishing is actually low. And having this sort of data visible to the public, visible to supply chain actors, is an incredibly important part of that, so that vessels can demonstrate that they're doing the right thing and that they're compliant. But where some vessels are acting illegally and we do detect them, yes, this system can be used to identify illegal fishing.
Now, Marshalls is the first Pacific country to come on board with this, but why haven't other Pacific nations signed up or, you know, shared their data despite the importance of fisheries in the region? Like, are there any barriers to Pacific nations participating?
From our perspective, certainly not. Marshall Islands actually came to us asking if we could work with them on using our platform to make their data public. So really, of course, we'd very much welcome other Pacific Island countries in a partnership to do the same thing.
Now, you mentioned sort of other work going on in the Pacific. Could you touch briefly on that? What are the sort of major focuses in this area in the Pacific at the moment?
Sure. I can give two examples. One is We work collaboratively with members of the FFA, the Forum Fisheries Agency, including the Forum Fisheries Agency Secretariat, on doing analysis based on satellite data. The second example is in relation to forced labour. This is some very cutting-edge work, and it's still very much a work in progress, but some research partners at the University of California in Santa Barbara have been using our data to build a model that uses the AIS data that we collect to see if there are patterns that are unique to or more commonly associated with vessels that we are known to have forced labour on board. We know this is a very important issue. This is a human rights issue. And, you know, many countries around the world are adopting modern slavery legislation and so forth, and are putting in place import restrictions when they know that there are cases of forced labour and other abuses on board fishing vessels. So they don't want seafood coming into their countries that's been caught by forced labour. So using these models, building a model, using machine learning and AIS data to detect whether vessels may have forced labour. So it's not about absolutely knowing it, because from a satellite you can't tell exactly what's happening on a boat, but some of them behave in particular ways, such as they spend a lot of time out at sea and they spend a lot of time a long distance from port, and other things like they spend a lot of time actually fishing. Yeah, we can use those sorts of identifiers to help us to identify which vessels are higher risk, so that when they do eventually come into port, or if you're doing a boarding and inspection at sea, you can narrow down which vessels you want to target, and you know where they are.
Dr. Kamal Azmi speaking there with Marion Farr. Now it's time to hear the latest news headlines out of the Pacific, and I'm joined by Faith McCulley. Good morning, Faith.
Good morning, Nick, and good morning to everyone listening.
Now first, let's head to Fiji, where we've been following the story of this Russian luxury yacht, Amadea, that's docked in Lautoka port. What's the latest there?
Yeah, so Fiji's Court of Appeal has rejected the defense lawyer's application for the vessel to stay in Fiji. Court has ruled that Amadea will be seized by the U.S. government, but will stay in Fiji for at least another month, Radio New Zealand reports. The Amadea, which arrived in Fiji on the 12th of April after an 18-day crossing from Mexico, is, according to the U.S. government, owned by Russian oligarch Suleiman Kerimov, and Fijian police with the U.S. law enforcement who have been in the country since the Amadea arrived in Fiji from Mexico boarded the yacht last week.
And that one's been attracting headlines all over the world, as has the next story, where we go to Solomon Islands. And Australian Foreign Minister Marissa Payne met with Solomon Islands for the first time since the security pact with China was signed. So tell us more.
Yeah, so Foreign Minister Payne met with her Solomon Islands counterparts in Brisbane after the Pacific nation signed the controversial security pact with China. She reiterated assurances from Solomon Islands that the country would not be used for a foreign military base. This exchange was the first high-level ministerial meeting between Canberra and Honiara since news of the security pact was leaked in March. Prime Minister Scott Morrison said he was pleased Senator Payne had been able to take up the quote-unquote sensible opportunity to meet with her counterparts in Brisbane.
Yes, another story that just keeps keeping on in this region. And lastly, over to Samoa, where some seasonal workers will be returning to Samoa for some bad behaviour.
Yeah, so almost 200 people from the regional seasonal employment scheme will be returning to Samoa this week for breaching contract, including bad behaviour, Radio Polynesia Samoa reports. Minister of Public Enterprise Enterprises confirmed this and also pointed out that the suspension of the scheme is temporary to allow consultations with the Australian and New Zealand High Commissioner. He reminded that successful applicants currently overseas that they are working overseas on permits, therefore they shouldn't abuse the opportunity. The minister said some went overseas while single but returned with a child, and some had extramarital status while at the scheme works. He clarified that a committee has been appointed to review this matter.
Fascinating stuff there. Thanks, Faith. Faith McCallay there with the latest news headlines from the Pacific. Now, over the weekend, it was Mother's Day, and I'm sure many of the listeners out there treated their mothers to something special. I certainly did. Went out to a play, which I hadn't done in quite a long time, with my mum, and then had a nice dinner. So for some of us, the day is a time to celebrate the women who raised us. And for those who've lost their mums, it can be incredibly tough and a time of remembrance. But every year, while brands and companies tell us it's a time to buy gifts and chocolates, there are discussions happening about whether that is the right way to tell our mothers we love them. Could highlighting the gender pay gap or the amount of unpaid labour our mothers do instead be the best way to celebrate them? I'm joined now by Fijian women's rights activist Sharon Bhagwan-Rolls. Sharon Bulla, and welcome to the show.
Good morning, Nick. Lovely to be joining you from Fiji today.
Now, how important are mothers to the fabric of Fijian and, in a wider context, Pacific Islander family life?
Well, Nick, while I do work from Fiji, I am a Fijian mother as well, and also a grandmother now, hashtag feminist nanny G. I also work with a diversity of mothers across, you know, our Pacific Island region. So I think I'll base my remarks on that. You know, we need to acknowledge first and foremost that indeed the role of mothers in our society is so important. There's such a strong legacy of mothers nurturing our Pacific women's rights and feminist movement, as well as, you know, maintaining peace and security in homes and communities. But we also need to recognize that there is a diversity of motherhood. We have single mothers, we have co-parents, we have aunts, grandmas, the big sisters, and the caregivers when mothers go to work. So we need to see mothers not only in a heteronormative framework anymore, that is, you know, mothers, you're a good mother if you can stay at home and provide and cook and wash, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact that motherhood is such an important fabric of Pacific Island society across our 22 Pacific Island countries and territories. So it's so important to recognize that diversity indeed.
And when you include all that diversity with mothers, there are obviously different challenges that these different types of mothers face. So what are some of those challenges that mothers in the Pacific do face?
So let's start off with what happens before you become a mother. As a single, you know, as a young girl, I think what's really important right now in looking at the work that a number of our partners are doing through the Shifting the Power Coalition, and particularly the Talitha Project in Tonga, that it's so important for our girls, our daughters, as well as our sons and our boys, to really have the access and a political understanding of sexual reproductive health and rights. So if we talk about the right to determination of what happens to your body, what kind of relationships, that's really important. The other thing also is, in a region where we have such low rates of political representation, how do we get better at supporting women's leadership, given that they are organizing, they're weaving together communities, you know, in good times and hard times. So that's really important. I also think it's really important as a mother myself, you know, looking at my son and my daughter, to see that our children have the autonomy to determine their roles in society, their social roles, their economic roles. So what is motherhood or what is parenthood in today's day and age? Then the other thing that I feel we really need to recognize is the amount of work that women do in caregiving, and not just because of what has happened because of COVID and the social economic impacts, but because we are living in the midst of a climate crisis, that we need to recognize, like you said at the outset, it's not about gifts of chocolates or God knows, you know, electronic items that we really don't need, but how do we actually really recognize what is happening to women's bodies because of the humanitarian consequences of nuclear testing, the climate crisis, and what it's doing to our land and our oceans as well. So there's so much going on when you think about motherhood and when you think about, yeah, the very essence of motherhood being part of our land, our oceans, and the, you know, what brings society together in many different ways.
Speaking with Fijian women's rights activist Sharon Bhagwan-Rolls. Sharon, when you drill down into it a bit more and talk about what the people with the political power and the resources can do, what are you hearing from the mothers around about what they need to feel supported at a family and community level?
So I think one of the things is there is an acknowledgement, of course, of the high rates of violence that we experience across the Pacific. And so we really want our Pacific leaders not just to talk about the rates of violence, but help us get to the root causes. What are the drivers of insecurities, violence in the home, violence in the community? Because that requires women's insights and leadership in preventing violence, in building peaceful communities. And the second point is, as Pacific leaders are going to be gathering together for the forum leaders meeting, can they look at their commitments through the Pacific Leaders Gender Equality Declaration and not simply just have declarations, but really operationalize their declarations in light with all the different commitments that they've made to women's rights, to feminist movement organizing, disability inclusion, social inclusion as well. And so that is where women's leadership is just so critical. So I hope greater collaboration, particularly with the Pacific Island women's rights and feminist movements going forward.
And of course, both Fiji and PNG are headed towards upcoming general elections. So how important are the votes of mothers and what will they be looking for from their governments?
I think, you know, the mothers as well as young women are certainly looking at what are the political commitments to women's rights. How are you not just going to make promises of women's participation? But, you know, one indicator at the end of the day for any Pacific government is how are you investing in those gender equality and human rights commitments in your national budget? One analysis is always, right, how much is being invested by governments in gender equality? How much is not only women's representation in communities, but what is also that support with the movement, the organizers? And obviously, you know, a lot of commitments will be made, but I hope, you know, and I'm sure mothers and daughters will also cast their vote, but also monitor those promises as well. As one mother said many, many years ago, almost 22 years ago, we don't just want sweet talk from political leaders, we want some very clear action.
A lot of things for governments and other political bodies to be listening to in the upcoming months and years. Thank you very much, Sharon. That's Fijian women's rights activist Sharon Bhagwan-Rolls speaking to me there.
What party people? Party people!
Every big hit, every try, and every contest.
Tonga, he explodes through, intercepted by Latrell Mitchell. Bye-bye!
Grandstand Rugby League brings you all the action.
And out goes himself to skipper and scores! He picks it up with glee. Try!
The 2022 NRL Premiership.
His eyes lit up. They were like dinner plates.
Absolutely champagne rugby league.
ABC Radio Australia, your home of rugby league in the Pacific.
It's just a month out from the Pacific Mini Games in the Northern Marianas, being the first major regional sporting event since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. Nine sports will be on show. Most will be on the main island of Saipan, and others on Tinian and Rota, including the triathlon. Stephen Damien is Papua New Guinea's representative with the Oceania Triathlon Union, and he's just returned from Rota, where he gave the Mini Games triathlon course his seal of approval.
Apart from officiating as a technical delegate at this event, part of my role was to also go over there prior to the race to do a test event to make sure that the course is suitable for the event that we're going to have. Also to train the local technical officials so that they're capable in officiating at these events, and also to meet with the local authorities because triathlon is not played in a enclosed facility like a stadium or a field. It's out in public areas, so we got to make sure that the public roads are closed for the cycle And then also we got water safety in the water for the open water swim. So that was part of my role when I went over for the test event on the weekend.
What's involved in the triathlon?
So triathlon is a three-event race. It's like swim, a cycle, and a run. It's got several different distances and several different formats for the Pacific Mini Games in Northern Marianas. There's going to be three races. The first one will be a sprint distance event, which comprises of a 750-meter swim, a 20K cycle, and a 5K run. That's on day one of the races. The first event will be on the 20th of June on a Monday. On the Tuesday, they will have a day of rest. And then on the 22nd of June, they will have two races. One of them is called a mixed team relay. And then immediately after that, they're going to have the aquathlon.
Stephen, and which countries in the region will be taking part in the triathlon?
Okay, so countries competing, it's seven countries altogether. Northern Marianas, the host country, Guam, Palau, Solomon Islands, Fiji, New Caledonia, and Tahiti.
And Papua New Guinea, being the biggest nation in the region, it's not taking part?
Yeah, unfortunately, Papua New Guinea is not sending a triathlon team to the specific mini games.
All the games will be played on the main island of Saipan, or is it going to be shared around some of the islands?
For the Pacific Mini Games, there'll be nine events. Seven events will be on the mainland, main island in Saipan. One will be in Tinian, which is beach volleyball, and triathlon will be on the other island, which is Rota Island.
June is just next month, so did you see that everything is being prepared now, or they're still working?
One of the good things about having the event in a public space is we don't have to build big stadiums or swimming pools. Everything is out in the open. So I think all our major work will be civil works, just to fix up, packing down parts of the road so it's safe for cyclists to cycle. Most of the roads in Rota are very good, actually. It's just a few sections that's a bit loose gravel, so it won't take too long for the civil authorities to compact the road and put a bit of sealant on it to make it so it's not slippery. Apart from that, I think the Games Organizing Committee is just making arrangements with the hotels to make sure there's plenty of rooms available for the athletes, for the athletes' village, and also for the officials and technical officials that they play. So I think in terms of preparations for the games, everything is in place. The local authorities, the municipal council is very supportive. They got plenty of support with the police to close off the roads, the Coast Guard looking after the water safety. They were all there to help out. So the hospital and its first responders are on the ambulances on standby during our race for the test event. So I'm pretty happy with the support for the event.
Papua New Guinea's representative with the Oceania Triathlon Union just back from Saipan, and he was speaking to Caroline Tiraman. Well, high up in the trees of Papua New Guinea's jungles lives the tree kangaroo. The month of May is all about raising awareness for these furry creatures that are endangered and under threat. Michelle McGeorge is an advisor for the Australasian Association of Zoos and Aquariums, and this year she is helping to establish Tree Kangaroo Day, and she joins me on the line. Good morning, Michelle.
Morning, Nick.
So how are preparations for Tree Kangaroo Day going? What's planned for this year?
Well, this is actually the first year that globally zoos are coming together and conservation organisations to celebrate tree kangaroos. So it's pretty exciting that it's the first one. And at the moment we have just under 50 zoos, conservation organisations globally that are committed to celebrating World Tree Kangaroo Day on the 21st. And a lot of that will be raising awareness, so a lot of social media, media in general, and a lot of zoos have activities planned within their sites, to celebrate tree kangaroos. I know some people are doing cookies, some people are doing face masks and other activities just to really raise awareness of this unique species, which is primarily found in Papua New Guinea.
So it sounds like you're getting a bit of buzz around the day, but why is it important to have a specific day of awareness dedicated to the tree kangaroo?
Yeah, tree kangaroos are a very unique species. As you mentioned, they live high up in a tree, and a lot of people aren't even aware that there are kangaroos that live high up in rainforest trees. But they do represent a flagship species in that, you know, organisations in Papua New Guinea that are protecting tree kangaroos and working with community groups to save and protect area are also saving all those other species below. And some of those species, like little tiny skinks, may not be as attractive and as exciting as a tree kangaroo. So they do represent a really important animal in that if we can connect visitors and people to tree kangaroos, hopefully we can also save all the other animals that live within the rainforest with them.
So you say that saving the tree kangaroo will also help to save other tree other animals. What other parts of the ecosystem do the tree kangaroo kind of help, or what role do they play in Papua New Guinea's ecosystem?
Yes, so they're one of the biggest land mammals in Papua New Guinea and on the island of New Guinea, and they are threatened by logging is a main one, and also land clearing due to population growth in Papua New Guinea. So the species that live within that rainforest, you know, PNG is one of the most biodiverse countries in the world. It's considered a biodiversity hotspot, with about 7% of the world's biodiversity only found on 1% of the landmass. So their role, obviously, they are a predator. They are eaten by big harpy eagles and snakes. But also, too, they have a really important role in terms of living up in the trees and, you know, seeds that they eat and things like that as well.
And I understand you are part of a push to get the PNG government to officially recognise Tree Kangaroo Day. So why do you believe it's important for the government specifically for them to recognise this day?
Yes, I've been very lucky in working with the PNG government to formally recognise World Tree Kangaroo Day, which would be their first, the country's first declared animal day. And the reason for that is that tree kangaroos provide a wonderful opportunity for us to globally get the world focused and looking at Papua New Guinea. Often, you know, people think of other countries with animals such as Africa or Brazil, and you get a lot of conservation effort that goes on in those countries. But because Papua New Guinea has such an important role with the third largest rainforest in the world, one of the most untouched rainforests in the world, it's so important that we get the global community focusing their attention on Papua New Guinea and supporting those conservation efforts. So, you know, using tree kangaroos as a way to raise awareness and then also then hopefully encouraging global community support to support those organisations in the field and those local community groups that are protecting tree kangaroos through funding support so that they can protect more and more conservation land in Papua New Guinea. And the government has an ambitious target of trying to reach 17% of land, terrestrial land, as conservation and protected areas. And they're working quite closely with the United Nations and supported by the United Nations Development Program. So tree kangaroos are one of those ways that we can get the global community behind supporting these conservation areas.
Yeah, definitely. And Michelle, finally, I have to ask, what's your favourite thing about tree kangaroos?
They're just such a cool animal. You know, they're so different from a normal kangaroo. You've got these big claws that are more like a koala's. You've got these powerful arms, so they kind of look a little bit more like a possum. And they've got these amazing tails that balance and hang, and they don't wrap around the tree, but they're also different as well. You've got 14 species of tree kangaroo across majority in Papua New Guinea. There's 9 species that are there, and then you have 3 that are endemic just to the Indonesian province of West Papua, and then 2 in Australia. But each of them are very different in their colours, their facial features. And so I just think that they're just such a cute animal and playing such an important role. And, you know, majority of them are threatened with and are endangered. And so if we don't work together as a global community to support Papua New Guinea's efforts for conservation, then we're at very real risk of losing these amazing creatures.
Yeah, they certainly are a very cool and very cute animal, as you say. Thanks very much for joining us, Michelle.
Thank you much.
That was Michelle McGeorge, an advisor for the Association of Zoos and Aquariums Saving Animals from Extinction Tree Kangaroo Program.
Pacific Beat.
Well, Australia produces more than 100 million oysters a year, worth tens of millions of dollars from hundreds of oyster farms across the country. It's a labour of love in many instances, where the slightest imperfection in water quality can be disastrous. But new research has found First Nations people were doing this for thousands of years before colonisation, not just in Australia, but across North America as well. Ian McNiven is a professor of Indigenous archaeology at Monash University, and he's a co-author on this study published in the journal Nature Communications.
In the past, we used to think that the use of the oysters was probably reasonably low-keyed, despite the fact that we have some very large oyster middens on the east coast of Australia, particularly in southern Queensland and in New South Wales. But I guess the key thing is that nobody really thought that there was some good sort of ideas sort of that would come through if we actually engaged First Nations communities to understand how they did their oystering, but on a large scale. And when we did this study, we thought, why don't we actually look at the size of some of these middens and then how many oysters are in those sites? So this is a study done both in Australia and also with my colleagues in the US. And it transpires that some of these sites literally have tens of millions of oysters. So what we're seeing is that over sometimes hundreds and even thousands of years, how did First Nations communities have such high yields of oysters, but did it in a sustainable way when in places like Australia, where in the late 19th century, when the commercial oyster fisheries got up and going, most of them collapsed within two decades of them starting up. So clearly First Nations peoples were doing something that we didn't know about.
I suppose the hard part about doing this research is the oyster beds that were accessed by First Nations peoples are gone. I mean, they're just not there anymore. So you're left with a pile of shells. Are you telling me that you're literally just counting the millions of shells to sort of find out the scale of those oyster beds before colonisation?
Yeah, I mean, one of the issues we have with sort of management of Australia's ecosystems and even marine ecosystems as well is that a lot of people don't quite appreciate just how productive they were before colonisation. But these archaeological sites, these cultural sites of First Nations, the midden shells, are telling us a very different sort of story. And I don't think that people quite appreciate that the only way you can get a midden with millions of shells in it is that the surrounding estuarine area must have been super productive in marine resources, in particular oysters. And that's what these middens are telling us, that in fact the baselines that we are using to understand what, the pre-colonial environment was like may in fact be quite wrong, because they've just been depleted so much that nobody actually knows anymore just how productive these ecosystems were. But the shell middens don't lie. They're telling us a very strong message there. And in fact, when you speak to a lot of Aboriginal elders, I mean, they have stories about just how extraordinarily productive certain areas, certain estuarine areas on their country were. And it's time that we started listening, I think, and also start doing some more archaeology to get a better idea of how to properly look after these estuaries, but also how to make better oyster fisheries that we can all enjoy.
Mm. Yeah, indeed. So, I mean, the First Nations people in North America, I don't know if they'd have the luxury of a Sydney rock oyster, but how do the experiences or the research between Australia's First Nations people compare with across the Pacific? What sorts of findings are kind of a parallel here?
High levels of oyster use. So, for example, in both the east and the west coasts of North America, so both in the US and Canada, you have some extraordinary shell deposits there, and particularly in Florida, where, I mean, there's a whole sort of ancient culture there that was operating in the last 1,000 years or so, First Nations culture there, where, I mean, some of these oyster middens, I mean, are better referred to as oyster mounds, and some of them are like 9 meters high and contain literally tens of millions of oysters. So we're talking about extraordinary high levels of oyster harvesting and consumption. But interestingly, and this is where you get the similarity with Australia as well, instead of just throwing the shells on the ground, the shells were used to create these sort of monumental features on the landscape. So there's a deep sort of symbolic value to the shells as well. It just wasn't thrown away as trash. It's the story of the shell, people want to maintain that and create these monuments on the landscape. And when you get like in Florida, which is pretty flat, and then you see like a 9-meter high hill and you wonder what it is, and you get up close and you realize it's actually solid oyster shell. And certainly in places like northern New South Wales and southeast Queensland, we have shell mounds there that some of them are up to sort of 2 meters high, but often they went for hundreds of meters. And I mean, a lot of that story is gone because in the late 19th century and early 20th century, non-Indigenous people used to, settlers used to quarry these sites for lime. Mm. So a lot of that story is gone, but there are sites left and there's plenty of stories to be told.
Ian McNevin is a Professor of Indigenous Archaeology at Monash University, speaking there to the ABC's Andy Park. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 3 p.m. PNG time with Richard Hewitt. I'll be joining you here for a couple of mornings a week throughout the month of May, so I'm really looking forward to that. I'm Nick Fogarty. Thanks for your company.